This is A Confused Heap of Facts, the podcast where we have a discussion about history with the faculty of the Department of Military History and the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Department of the Army, Department of Defense, or U.S. government. This is Dr. Jonathan Abel, and I'm here with Dr. John Hostler.
Hi, thanks for having me.
This is our department medievalist, and we're going to talk about one of the more certainly popular and contentious aspects of medieval military history, which is the Crusades, on one of the many subjects on which Dr. Hostler is an expert. So let's start at kind of the very beginning, in a very obvious place. We use Crusades kind of now with a small c, or crusade perhaps. And I think it's probably lost a lot of its historical mooring. So when we're talking about the medieval period, the late medieval period, what is a crusade?
That's a very difficult question to answer because there have been lots of definitions of what a crusade is. Some of them have been well accepted. Some of them have been rejected over time. The problem is sort of where do you start with the definitions? Clearly, it's a holy war, mm-hmm. right? It's a Christian holy war. Mm-hmm. Although, as you say, crusade is used a lot of ways now. But it's, in its origin, it's Christian holy war, right? Mm-hmm. A Christian holy war to where? Does it have to be a holy war that goes to a certain place? Does it have to be a holy war that is called by a certain person? For example, does it need to be called by the Pope in Rome?
Right.
Does it have to have a certain character in terms of what the goal is, what the purpose is, who is on the campaign? Have they taken oaths? Are they receiving indulgences? And so on and so forth. So you get into the weeds pretty quickly in terms of what it actually is. That is complicated by the fact that the term crusade actually comes really after the crusading period. We have lots of other versions of what's going on, but none of them match it exactly. So defining it is very difficult. So typically where I start off is I say, okay, it is a Christian holy war, right? Mm-hmm. It begins, I think, and people will disagree with me, with the notion of recovering holy land.
Now I know you're not using a definite article there, so you're not saying the holy land. Is that on purpose?
Right. Yes. Now certainly the first ones, and we can get into this when we get into the various schools of thought. The first crusade that everybody knows is directed at Jerusalem, and so we think the holy land. But if you keep it broad to the idea of lands that are thought to belong to Christ. That have been under the auspices of Christian governments in the past, mm-hmm. That may no longer remain under those auspices. So they're ruled by Muslims, they're ruled by pagans. The Christian presence, well, maybe still in the land politically, it belongs to somebody else. Mm-hmm. The problem is even saying that it gets very complicated because there will be crusades. That are launched against currently Christian lands,
right.
Lands that are dominantly Christian but have been overwhelmed by, say, heresy, and even crusades against individual people. So you get in the weeds really, really fast with this. Mm-hmm. So it may be helpful to instead separate it by time and say, okay, if you're talking about the 11th century, which is when the crusades are really, you know, become a thing. What was the crusade about then? What was crusading about in the 12th century? What was it about in the 13th century? And then after the fall of Acre in 1291, which is traditionally seen as the end of the first major crusading period, what was crusading about in the later crusades? And right. then in ideas even after the later crusades, you start talking about people like Martin Luther, who are supportive of efforts that seem like crusades against the Ottomans and whatnot.
Right.
Then they start to become very different indeed. So
right.
So it's a complicated thing, and you know, in the class I teach here about it, I try to make that apparent from the very beginning. And my usually what I say is if somebody tells you a crusade is this and gives you a precise definition, it's either wrong or can easily be debated.
Right. No, that certainly makes sense. I want to clarify one point. You say that this is a Christian process. Does that include Eastern Christianity, what's often referred to as Orthodox Christianity?
Ooh, that's another minefield right there. There have been some who have suggested that, because certainly if you want to talk about Eastern Orthodoxy and its connections to warfare, there are many, and they're continuing they're in the present day. Calling them crusades has been done. People will see, for example, very early on, the Emperor Heraclius going on a campaign, and at the end of the campaign, he rescues a piece of the True Cross from the
right.
Persians.
And then we're talking way back in, this is what, 7th, 8th century?
This is the early 7th century.
Yeah,
early 600s. And people have come out and said, well, that sort of looks like a crusade to me, right? I mean, the Persians take over the Holy Land. They grab the piece of the True Cross. Heraclius, the most Christian emperor, fights against them. The Persians are, well, there are a number of things, including Zoroastrians, right? He liberates the land. He restores the cross. He triumphantly enters Jerusalem. It sure looks like a crusade, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so people have said that, and then the crusade historians have turned around and just absolutely bashed the people who are suggesting such a thing. Because, and again, it gets back to the definition. If crusading is a Christian holy war, then maybe what Heraclius is doing fits the bill if you can show it's a holy war. Is his purpose for fighting for the reconquest of Christian lands, or is it a political interest and the Persians have taken just his land and
right.
he wants it back? He wants
right.
to restore the borders of Byzantium. It includes all these religious aspects.
Right.
And that, and really crusading ideology, which comes much later, and you can see in the preaching of the crusade and the different emphases and norms of crusading, the stitching the cross on the clothes, the
right.
The pilgrim badges, the you know, there's hundreds of things. Well, those are absent. You don't
right.
see those kinds of things. So it's all, even if you get to the place where you say, well, it may be a holy war, yeah, but is it a crusade? Right. If you look at, for example, in Anglo-Saxon England, it's a similar story. You see the Anglo-Saxons going on wars against pagans in Scotland, for example, right? And the language in the sources is couched in highly religious terms. The most Christian king, Æthelstan, you know, gathered his forces together and marched north against the heathen Scots. And
right.
okay, so is that a holy war? Maybe it's a holy war. But is it a crusade?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and I see that as an early modernist. There are holy wars called against the Ottomans, and they still use the same language. You know, when Frederick II of Prussia wins a battle in 1758, his newspapers all say, you know, the great Protestant king won against the Catholics. So,
mm-hmm. right.
yeah, that's fascinating. Yeah. So I think if we kind of draw concentric circles around what are commonly accepted to be crusades, I think the center of that is certainly going to be the first four crusades, as we number them now. Am I incorrect in saying that?
Usually the way it breaks down is, I would say the first three.
Mm-hmm.
The first three crusades, because the fourth is such a debacle, it's kind of seen as something a little separate, whether right or wrong. Also, the fact that it's in the 13th century. So, you know, the first crusade ends in Jerusalem in 1099, so you basically have 100 years after that.
Okay.
So usually the first three, and then the next five are kind of a piece.
Okay. So let's start with those first three, the ones that I think are least contentious to be called crusades.
Hmm.
Why does this happen? Why at the end of the 11th century do people in Europe suddenly decide we need to go retake Jerusalem?
Right. And that, I will point out, is a loaded question because of your use of the word suddenly. Right. There's been a lot of criticism in certain circles, not all accepted, of the it's referred to as the Big Bang theory of crusading. Right. So in 1095, Pope Urban II goes to Clermont in France and he gives this sermon in which he, you know, he encourages the bishops to go out and recruit for this great adventure, which would become known as the Prince's Crusade or the First Crusade, right? And so the Big Bang Theory holds that somehow it occurred to Urban, or perhaps was built on some things coming earlier, that this is what was needed. Mm-hmm. And it was probably needed because, as the argument goes, he's in correspondence with the Byzantine Emperor in the East, who requests military assistance. He gets this request, goes out, gives this speech. A crusade is generated, and boom, you've got the First Crusade, right? Big Bang Theory. It's a little bit of a cynical name for it, right? And there's one particular historian sort of argued against the Big Bang Theory. And mm-hmm. I tend to be more sympathetic with his views than some others, because most crusade historians, if not all, would admit that there are preludes, right? Indications, developments in advance of Urban's mm-hmm. speech that build up. And this is where it gets really complicated, as you say, whether it appeared suddenly, whether it appeared gradually, why?
Right.
Why did it happen, right? And there have been all kinds of reasons given. So I already mentioned the recovery of Christian land in general mm-hmm. as a motivating factor. The question I usually ask my students is, well, if that's the motivation, right, you have the Muslim conquests of the Levant, North Africa, Egypt, and into Spain, which are all wrapped up by the end of the 8th century, right? So why no crusade with Charlemagne? Why no crusade with the Ottonians? Why no crusade, right? And certainly they're involved in things. I mean, Charlemagne does go to Spain, and he does mm-hmm. fight against, you know, Muslim forces down there. But you don't have this great generation of Spain. But the idea generally is that, well, maybe we can't. Europe is emerging from the fragmentation of late Rome. We don't have the combat power. We don't have the political organization. It's just kind of a thing that's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. The Byzantines themselves, there are a couple campaigns into the Levant. It's not entirely clear if those are holy ventures, in a sense, right? But you don't have any of this stuff. What you do have are sort of hints and allegations of things to come. So, for example, one that used to be talked about a lot is the so-called peace and truce of God movements, mm-hmm. Pax Dei, the Truga Dei, right? The idea that starting in the 10th century, the church tries to limit collateral damage during campaigns. You have all these Christian principalities, territories fighting against each other. In order to tap down the blood and the violence, the peace of God is declared in certain places, predominantly in France. And this is a very local phenomenon. It was never, you know, continent-wide. A peace is declared in which you are forbidden from shedding the blood of clergy, of civilians, of non-combatants.
Yeah, and I think it's worth pointing out, this is not France as a stable polity. This is the West Franks this is essentially a failed state at this point.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to put it. It's definitely fragmented, right? Yeah. I mean, you know, France itself is this sort of nascent little small
right.
thing.
Whereas the Ottonians yeah. in Germany have built a solid polity that, at least for the time being, is far more coherent. So it kind of yes. makes sense that this is happening in the West Frankish lands.
Yeah, where things are a bit more chaotic,
right,
they're more
right,
in play.
Right.
Yeah, and so the thought is, oh well, that's, you know, limiting collateral damage. That kind of restrains what you can do in warfare, particularly
right.
if you want to do raiding of villages and towns. And
which, if I'm remembering correctly, like, it's kind of how you pay for wars back then. You kind of expect people to find what they need on campaign, particularly coin and loot.
Yeah, it's part of the pay for the soldiers.
Yeah.
So, sure. So there's that, and then once you get into the 11th century, it's so-called truce, which says, okay, well, if you're going to fight, we already know you can't kill non-combatants. And we're going to restrict you on what days you're allowed to fight. So no fighting on holy days, no fighting on Sundays, no fighting during Lent, no fighting during Advent, right? And so all these restrictions, so there used to be this big theory that said the knights were bored, right? They had no way to, no outlet for their anger. And these people just had to fight. They, you know, they grew up their whole life. And so the Crusades were an outlet, right?
Yeah.
And you say, well, okay, it's an interesting idea. It might be part of it. It's not the main driver of these things. These peace meetings are taking place so far in advance of the actual First Crusade, right? That this view is it's basically untenable, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's the other idea. There are many. Is okay. So maybe it's not the peace and truce of God. Maybe it is this reconquest of formerly Christian lands. Okay. So, and this is certainly the Muslim interpretation. If you look back on what the Muslim commentators are saying, you start to see Christian movements, armed movements into places like Sicily, Iberia, hints into North Africa, and then eventually towards the Holy Land. And it kind of looks like Christianity has almost some, from the Muslim perspective, some grand strategy, right? Mm-hmm. Of directed from Rome, where we're kind of reaching out and retaking these lands. So you have the so-called Reconquista in Spain, right? As a prelude to crusading. You have Pope Gregory the VII. I'm giving a talk on this later this year. Gregory the VII, who actually suggests a holy war, you know, two decades before mm-hmm. Urban. Maybe we should get an army together and go and liberate Jerusalem. So this is like, well, okay, so it's this growing movement towards, we want to recover Christian lands. So why don't we do that? But you have to gather your strength, you have to strategize, you have to organize, and that in the 10th and early to mid 11th century, it's very difficult to do that given the fragmented natures of states, mm-hmm. The way armies are raised. Mm-hmm. Most medieval armies are very small. Mm-hmm. Armies fight for 2-3 month contracts.
Right. Chronically short of money and food.
Yeah. You know, sustaining this venture over 3,000 kilometers is, you know, this is a very difficult thing, right? And tied into that, and this is interesting because I studied under a specialist in this, the whole question of, well, why do you think that land is even Christian to begin with? Because you can go back and say, okay, we're recovering Christian land because this used to be the Roman Empire. And Constantine legalizes Christianity, becomes Roman territory, right? And this all is sort of forgets for the moment that, you know, who owned the land before Constantine, right? Well, it was the pagan Romans. Well, how did the pagan Romans acquire their land, particularly in the Holy Land? Well, you've got this problem of the Jews, right? And the Old Testament, in which God is purportedly saying, you know, I'm giving this land to you. It's the promised land for the people of Israel, not for the Romans, and certainly not for 11th century medieval Christians living in, in Normandy.
Who are not, often across Europe, not particularly kind to Jews.
No. And so that's kind of an interesting angle. The scholars study anti-Judaism and this idea of disinheritance, right? If the Jews, as according to the story, have lost their claim to the land because of the crucifixion. Right. And so now it belongs to Christians. So those things are kind of the backdrop, right?
Kind of in the wind.
Yeah, they're in the wind. The knights are bored, maybe, right? The classic riposte to that is the Christians had nowhere else to fight. You can tell the Anglo-Saxons that in 1066, when William the Conqueror enters England with the papal flag being sponsored by the Pope to go and kill fellow Christians to conquer England, right? So all of this about, well, Christians aren't allowed to fight each other. No, that's not true. They're absolutely allowed to fight each other.
Yeah, and I think it's worth pointing out, I see this in my period, but I know it's common in the medieval period too. I think one of the origins of this idea is deterministic, that there was a peace and truce of God, the Christians couldn't kill each other, is all these rulers professed these things and then did the opposite of them. Yeah. Frequently, right?
Oh, yeah, of course. This is what you do. Well, you also have to say, who's making the rules, and do they actually have any political power to enforce them? Mm-hmm. I hear from students all the time, oh, well, you know, in the Middle Ages, everything was ruled by the Pope. And no, yeah. Right? So you get these Lateran councils in the 12th century. You're not allowed to use mercenaries anymore. And what do the kings do? They go and hire a bunch of mercenaries.
Right.
You're not allowed to use crossbows against other Christians, but you can use them against Muslims. And what do you have? Oh, well, here are the English using crossbows against the French.
Right.
So the Pope says one thing and then rulers and kind of end up doing the other, right?
Right. And this is also the age of the tension, especially in the East Frankish lands, between the civil control and church control, particularly mm-hmm. of the powerful benefices.
Yeah. And so it's a hot mess, right? The other bit I would say, though, is, along with all that background, right, I'm trying to get to an answer to your question here, right? It's difficult, right? I am also of the persuasion, and not everybody agrees with this, of the so-called traditionalist school of crusading history, which I don't entirely agree with, but there's these major schools of thought about how to interpret the Crusades. One of them is the traditionalist school, which says that it's all about Jerusalem.
Right.
That the First Crusade is a crusade to Jerusalem. Crusades, in a sense, are Christian holy wars aimed at the Holy Land, right?
Mm-hmm. Now we're using the definite article.
The definite article, the Holy Land, right? The Levant. And why? Because, well, Urban II talks about Jerusalem specifically in his pitch. And what he's talking about Jerusalem is about the fact that Muslims have control of the city, that the Holy Sepulchre, the place of the burial of Christ, is under threat, and that Christians are being tortured and abused by their Muslim overlords, right? And this is an interesting thread, because whether you want to say the Crusades were always aimed at the East, and I don't think that they were, right? I think that the notion develops over time. But Jerusalem is central. I think it's impossible to separate Jerusalem from crusading. Mm-hmm. And some of that background that leads up to it, there's a number of events in Jerusalem that are considered sort of formative. So in 1009, for example, the caliph of Egypt, the Shia caliph by the name of Al-Hakim the Mad, right, sends his forces to Jerusalem, and they destroy the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Right. And the reasons why they do this are just shows you kind of the complexity. There are authors in Europe who, of course, blame the Jews. And the Jews had given him information that led to the destruction of the church. So you see these conspiracy theories. And apparently, on the basis of this, there's this supposed early letter from Pope Sergius IV calling for a crusade. Mm. Still a big fight about whether that letter is authentic or not. If it is, then you can say, well, this event kind of sparked the thinking in the West that maybe we need to go do something.
Because kind of a watershed moment.
Yeah, because it's one thing to say, well, the Muslims rule over Jerusalem. Okay, fine. But you could still go there. You could visit on a pilgrimage. You could pray at Christ's tomb. But now if they're actually attacking the tomb,
right,
then now it's a pressing matter. It's urgent.
Right.
So that could be it. Well, it's interesting. After he destroys it, eventually the church is rebuilt. I found in my research it's part of the funds for the rebuilding come from Al-Hakim's own mother, who kicks in for the reconstruction,
right?
And it becomes a very popular pilgrimage place again. You have several powerful lords from Western Europe visiting and taking pieces of the wall and bringing it back, right?
Yeah.
But then as the 11th century goes, it's like, well, okay, the sepulchre comes under renewed threat. There are other things happening there. It's converted into a mosque at one point. There is the so-called German pilgrimage in the 1060s, where you have these thousands of German pilgrims who get attacked on the way to Jerusalem. So now the question is, well, if the sepulchre is under threat, if the people going on pilgrimage are under threat, it's right. Not really safe anymore. Maybe they need our help.
Yeah, and there's both a Levantine and there's also, if I'm remembering correctly, a Muslim tradition of protecting pilgrims, protecting travelers.
Yes, and this is very interesting because the people attacking the German pilgrims in the 1060s are these Sunni tribes in the northern reaches, and the people who protect them are actually Shia riders that are sent out by the vizier of Egypt to escort these pilgrims safely to Jerusalem so they can say their prayers. And that's actually brought up later on by the Egyptians to say, you know, we've protected you in the past.
Right.
But that whole idea, I mentioned Pope Gregory VII, who becomes pope in the 1070s. He's thinking about these things when he's musing about a possible expedition. He hasn't been there, but he's heard the stories about the sepulchre being hurt and pilgrims being attacked. And he's getting, supposedly these messengers. It's kind of odd. You trace through his letters and try to figure out who are these messengers, where are they coming from, right? When are they showing up at his court, bringing this kind of information? And so maybe that's the momentum that's gathering behind it. And when Urban is sitting there and he gets these letters from the East, this is kind of the final move. He figures he has enough political power at the time to compel the lords, or at least persuade them through his own bishops to raise an army. So it's kind of this gathering storm. And then, as I mentioned, the Big Bang says that, you know, it's Urban that crystallized all this together.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you believe that or not is an open question. But that's why everybody focuses on 1095, on Clermont, and they say this is how the Crusades started. But if you read through the accounts of his sermon in 1095, we don't have a copy. We only have accounts, some who claim to have been there. He feeds on all these themes. you see a lot of them. You see, you know, we need the strength of our knights to be wielded against a proper foe. Is that an allusion to the truce of God?
Right.
I don't know. He definitely talks about Jerusalem. He talks about our Eastern Christian brothers who are suffering. It's mm-hmm. reference to the Orthodox, right?
Right.
But there is no one reason. Right. It's a collage.
Right.
And so typically I say, what caused the First Crusade? If you give me an answer, I'll say yes. Give me another answer, I'll say yes, absolutely. But I tend to think they all have a part
right.
in it.
Yeah, it turns out geopolitics are complicated.
Yeah, shocking.
Yeah, so you could tell me if this is unfair, but the way I tend to see it is there's kind of three groups of people who go, especially on these early crusades. There's the true leaders, the people who are kings or the equivalent of dukes, kind of the high-level lords. There's the mid-level lords, kind of the counts and lesser lords who often become the on-the-ground leaders. And then there's the regular people, whether those are pilgrims, whether those are people who go to fight, or people who just kind of go. And there's an infamous children's crusade involved as well. So do you think that's fair, first of all? Like, it's kind of grouped them into those three categories.
Yeah, I'd probably disagree, I guess. I think it's exceedingly complex. Scholars have done a lot of good work in the last 10 years or so on the social makeup of mm-hmm. the Crusaders and who's there and what do they represent and where are they coming from. I think it's bedeviled by the fact that the First Crusade, there are no kings.
Right.
Right. So right off at the beginning, it's not a royal venture.
Right.
Even though the kings may well support these ventures, sometimes that's difficult to figure out. They're not going themselves. So, and even the lords who go are not your most powerful principal lords in the West. Now, you've got some who are very notable. So Robert Curthose on the First Crusade, the brother of the King of England, the son of William the Conqueror. He is very prominent in his locale, absolutely. Others who go say, I don't want to call them minor lords. They're not middling, perhaps is the better way.
Yeah.
They see opportunity. They have perhaps other reasons for going, acquisition of landed properties or rents or something like that. You have the Italians who have longstanding grudges against the Byzantines and who have fought against some of these Muslim groups and have corresponded with, say, the Egyptians and have a familiarity with what's going on in that locality. And I think that stew is pretty complex in sorting out what is their purpose. And then that's, again, what makes people love studying the First Crusade, because they come back and say, okay, all of these interests, all these motivations, what brings all these people together,
mm-hmm.
right? What is the one thing that they all find in common, right? And it's just unfortunate that still eludes us beyond a vague sort of sensibility of fighting for God, which you can do anywhere,
mm-hmm.
right? Something is tying these people together. And then you have, and the First Crusade's a great success. In the Second Crusade, and I should point out, these numbered crusades, I have a friend who does not like the numbering. He refuses to use them. And I get it. Because, you know, after the First Crusade, well, you have the Crusade of 1101. You have these smaller groups of armed pilgrims going to buttress the forces in the East. Are these crusades,
mm-hmm.
right? They're not grand expeditions, but they're certainly organized ventures led by some pretty influential people. So when we count the crusades, we're obscuring. A story is really sort of more or less continuous movement of soldiers back and forth between the East.
Okay.
But even putting that aside for the minute, when you get to the Second Crusade, all of a sudden you have the King of France going. Right, you have Conrad from Germany going. You all of a sudden now you're at that royal tier, right? And the Third Crusade, being the most famous of the sort of Crusade of Kings, you have Richard the Lionheart, Philip Augustus, and Frederick Barbarossa, and they all go on the same venture, right? Whereas later Crusades, the Fifth is supposed to have Frederick II along, but he doesn't make it for very complicated and crazy reasons, Then later you have the French Crusades with Louis the Ninth, so you have the most Christian of the kings leading them, right?
The future saint.
Yeah, but then other crusades like the Barons Crusades are literally barons, mm-hmm. right? It's from England, one from France.
Right.
So I think at the top level, mm-hmm. it sort of defies any sort of any sort of generalization other than to say you have principals in Europe who are landholders who have wealth, who are going for reasons of obligation, opportunity, various motivations. Now, beneath them, I think is where it gets a bit more interesting, because now you have to subdivide and you talk about the rest, right? You know, Georges Duby, right? I mean, he has classic, the three orders, right? Those who fight, those who pray, and those who work, right? Well, some of them are those who fight because you have knights going. You have their squires going. You have fief holders who hold things. They have landed titles, and they might hold a money fief. They've got some kind of an income coming from the crown, right? People with a little bit of means who we would definitely not say are among the working class. Many of these sorts of people will go. Many common soldiers will go. People who are called up as infantry for regular campaigns, who end up taking the oath and going on campaign, and then you have, of course, all the camp followers and the families and the laundresses and the prostitutes and we don't talk about this much at this school, right? But armies go places and people follow them, right?
Right. Mobile cities.
Yeah, kind of little mobile cities. During the Third Crusade, they expel. They say, okay, look, we're going to move on here, and the women can't come with us, right? And you actually, you have to get control of the enterprise. So you've got a whole cross section of sort of the Western Christian world, and then included in that, where do you put the clergy, right? Because you have priests who go, you have minor clerics, you have monks, you have canons, you have future saints like Francis of Assisi, as well as deacons, archdeacons, bishops, who sometimes are out there doing the fighting, defending a camp, leading a charge, right? So you've got all three sort of medieval orders, if you want to put them in there, mixed together. And then even the so-called fourth order that when you study kind of at the undergraduate level medieval history, it was talk about the 13th century and the emergence of this new group of people, the merchants.
Right.
Where do they fit in, right? They're not working the land. They're not swinging a sword. So what are they? They make their profit from, not from land, but from stacks of coins, right? You have the merchants involved in the Crusades. I mean, during the Third Crusade, an acre, before the city's even taken, the representatives from Genoa and Venice and other Italian locales, right, are fighting over who gets what in the city because of where the district is located. Is it near the port? Is it going to facilitate trade?
Right.
Is it going to make
them
money? And then later on, once you get to the Fifth and Sixth Crusades in that period, you've got Venetian arm dealers who are shipping weapons back and forth to the Levant, selling them to both Christians and Muslims, basically anywhere they can get a buyer.
Yeah.
So as the further you go, it gets very, very complicated. And the answer is, who goes on a crusade? Well, everybody. Nobody, right? It could be any kind of mix that you could think of. And I think that's what makes them so interesting and different from other wars that you study, where, the stuff we study here at CGSC is, Napoleon, he gathers the people, the levy en masse, right? And conscripts, they're all Frenchmen, but they're put in uniform and they're soldiers and they're given pay, right? You are now in the Grand Army, right? As opposed to people not wearing uniforms, right? Not receiving central pay, but as you say, grabbing booty in cities, perhaps receiving some kind of daily wage, depending on what campaign you're talking about, getting money in advance, trying to figure out how to buy their food.
Right.
It's a complicated, much more diverse social enterprise than we think of with modern war making.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one of the things I really want to talk about is when we look back at religion in history, modern people are often cynical about it. They often try to reach beyond a belief motive for things like, why is this French count going to the Levant? Well, clearly he wants the trade tax revenues from Ashkelon, right? Mm. So kind of at the different levels you talked about, however you want to parse it, where do you think the religious motivation fits here?
Yeah, I think you can't separate it. The attempts that have been done to say that the Crusades are just a crass enterprise for money and cash, I sympathize with them because the Crusaders are grabbing a lot of cash and a lot of land. I mean, right. they certainly are, right?
Right.
So you can't say there is no profit motive here, right? It's just not sustainable. Is that the reason they went, though? And that's always the question. I'm convinced that in later Crusades, yes, absolutely. And people know what the opportunity is like. Earlier Crusades, I don't know, maybe. Jonathan Riley Smith swatted down pretty well in the 1990s this idea that that they were going for cash, that it was all profit motive.
Yeah, purely profit
motive, yeah, right? Yeah, yeah. He just smashed it down. And he's been a little controversial because in 1980, he came up with this very important essay called Crusading as an Act of Love, which really seems counterintuitive,
yeah,
right?
Right.
But what he's talking about is, and this has been deepened ever since he wrote that, been deepened by his own graduate students and by other people who are sort of inspired by his work. When we say religion, you have to get very specific. What do we mean religion? Okay, I'm going and fighting for God.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. That's not nearly specific enough. I'm going and fighting for Jesus. I'm lopping off a head for Jesus. I'm lopping off a Muslim head for Jesus or a pagan head for Jesus. Okay, but why? Why do you think Jesus wants or needs you to do that, right? And so I mentioned the schools of thought. There's this other school of thought that is referred to as pluralism, right? Which stresses the penitential aspects. What does going on crusade do for you? Well, perhaps it is a act of penance, mm-hmm. in which a contrite Christian can make up for their confessed sins, mm-hmm. right? And here we're talking about theologians refer to as the particular judgment of the soul, right? The notion that someday I'm a Christian soldier, I've killed a lot of people, I've done some bad things. Someday I'm going to die and God is going to judge me. I better hope that my soul is pure because God cannot tolerate the sight of sin. I won't enter heaven with an impure heart. So that might mean in the Catholic view of things, I might spend some time in purgatory before going to heaven, or maybe my sins are so heinous that I won't even get to purgatory. I'll go straight to hell. So crusading as a penitential act, as a way to ultimately wash away your sins, in which case the motivation is highly individualistic.
Right.
Right. And you see people who talk about these things. Riley Smith commented on the looking at charters and letters from individual crusaders, right? People talking about my manifold sins and the state of my soul, mm-hmm. right? And their worry is about themselves.
Right.
Right. And sure, it's fighting for God, but it's fighting for God is the is just the background to what you're doing, right? You're really doing this because you recognize you're a sinful person, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you go down that road of pluralism, this means you have to start looking at the theology. You need to look at indulgences because the indulgence promise seemed to shift with every crusade. Mm-hmm. I have a colleague in Denmark who's written an extraordinary book about this. And you go through and you say, wow, well, the indulgence that is offered in the first crusade, right, versus what's offered in the second crusade, the third crusade, the fourth crusade, right? So maybe it has something to do with that, right? You're talking about a penitential society.
Yeah, and for those of us, those people who are not aware of what indulgences are, they are conditional forgiveness of sins within the Catholic construct. So if you do these things, if you go on this pilgrimage, if you go on this holy war, then your sins will be forgiven once you do the things that are laid out in the indulgence.
Yeah, and it gets in the weeds, right? Because is it that your sins are forgiven? Is it that your penance is
right.
forgiven, right? Now, the retort to that is, okay, sure. Yes, we have penitential evidence. We absolutely do, right? And you can tie it into what I was talking about earlier, this theme of pilgrimage, right? People,
which is common in the medieval world.
Absolutely common, right? And you're going on pilgrimage either, it could be a penitential activity. It could be for the reasons people go to Lourdes today.
Right.
Because you're sick and you're looking.
Minus the axes.
Yeah, looking for a miracle, right? I don't know. Maybe people still bring them, right?
Sure.
So there's all that. On the other hand, if you look at what is granted by pilgrimage, by crusading, strictures changes with time. So eventually the law starts to catch up with these things. So it becomes, if you take the crusading oath, right, the church is going to grant you an indulgence, provided you do whatever is explained, right? The state is going to provide you with indemnification against certain problems you might have in your life. So if you owe money, well, that is suspended, or in some cases canceled if you go on crusade, right? If you have a mortgage that you're having trouble paying, that goes away. If there's a legal judgment against you, it can be suspended, right? So the joke is that you have some very powerful figures who, and I would think key among them is Frederick II is one, but the other one that makes me laugh is King John in England, who repeatedly promises to go on crusade to get out of the political tangles he's found himself in.
Right.
And to some degree, it works. Sometimes it doesn't work, right?
Right.
So then you say, okay, well, somebody says, this is where you have to be, historians are just, or at least they should be, the most ridiculous skeptics in the world, right? So here's a charter. Here's somebody saying, for the sake of my soul, I will go on pilgrimage. And you say, oh, okay, let's study this guy a little bit more. Oh, it turns out he owes a lot of money to the local moneylender. Well, that's been wiped away, right? And he's got this problem. He got in trouble with the sheriff, and that's suspended by his crusade.
Right.
And so what is really driving that person? Is it all of those things? Is it just one? Is the penitential act just a cover to get out of these other judgments against you? And so you can get very skeptical and very, you read enough of it, very cynical, and you start asking, is anybody telling the truth here?
Right.
And then you get some very pious people that you don't find anything in their record. You say, I can't find, evidence being what it is, I can't find any judgments against this person. I can't see any reason why they're using the crusade to get out of a jam. They honestly believe,
mm-hmm.
and they want to go. And so figuring out in an army of 70,000 people,
right,
for which we have very fragmented and very poor evidence, who is going for what reason.
Right. There's probably at least 140,000 motivations in that army.
Yeah. I mean, it's tough. And that's for those, as you mentioned, everybody else, right? The soldiers.
Right.
Now the lords, different story, much better evidence on them, and you can pull out incredibly specific political reasons, economic reasons, right? And you can be very, very cynical about that. You have somebody who's professing Christianity at the height of their lungs, absolutely, but they want to be the king of Jerusalem.
Right.
And this is where Frederick II has been such a lightning rod for so long, that the German emperor who dies in 1250, who's excommunicated multiple times, yet recovers Jerusalem during the Sixth Crusade, and is immediately denounced by the bishops in the region for stealing the throne for unchristian reasons, and for commiserating with Muslims and doing all kinds of awful things, right?
Right.
What's the story of Frederick's heart at the end of the day? Right. What is actually inside here? Because there have been some who have suggested, despite all the noise, this is a pious Christian who went to daily masses, who endowed monasteries, who gave away family fortunes, and sure, there's all the other stuff. But at the end of the day, he really did believe, he really was pious. And that was the reason he went. And hence, cue the fighting. Right? Whether or not you agree with that interpretation.
Right. Yeah, and I find, you brought up Napoleon earlier, I find people's opinions of Napoleon often say the same, more about them than they do about Napoleon, which
yeah.
is, I think what you're saying is there's a bit of a mirror here as well.
I think so.
Yeah.
And I should add, while we're on it, the other religious, the big religious one you hear about, right? I mentioned the particular judgment of the soul, right? But there is another school of thought, the so-called popularists, who have been more in vogue lately, saying that people are going for eschatological reasons, right? Because this crusade, particularly the first one, the belief is that if we can get to Jerusalem and rescue it from its Muslim overlords and restore the Holy Sepulchre, this is the moment where Christ will return.
Right. This is the Christian apocalypse story. It happens in the Levant.
And that, the heavenly Jerusalem will descend from the skies to meet the earthly Jerusalem,
right.
And Alpha and Omega will come together, and it will be the end of times. And it really depends on what evidence you're looking at, right? If you're looking at the charters, you're not really seeing that. But if you're looking at the chronicles,
right.
The people, some of them who are going along on the crusade and witness some of these things, it can be very strong in places. Mm-hmm. Now, I think there's been some overreach by the popularists who want to see sort of everything as apocalyptical. But at the same time, it's hard to deny. And you look at the campaigns, particularly the First Crusade, and well, what happens as they're marching? They have these victories that they seem to snatch out of nowhere. There's the discovery of the so-called Holy Lance in Antioch, right? The spear that pierced the side of Christ. Just found, you know, in a hole in a quarter of the city, right? This is proof that God is sponsoring this expedition, right? People who are swearing oaths that they saw God's angels fighting with the host to defeat Kerboga outside the city. These things start to stack up and you say, okay, well, these are very dramatic chroniclers who are adding these splashes of things. Okay, sure. And you don't have to believe whether there was a miracle, whether it was the relic, whether angels were fighting. You don't have to believe any of that. The question is did these medieval authors believe it? And some of them did not. And they point out and they say, that's not the real Holy Lance. I'm not buying it. Some of them are very forthright. Right? Others are believing in it. And then you say, okay, given all of that, does that explain why these people are doing this? Why do tens of thousands of people... this is really the core question that I think we kind of started with. Why do tens of thousands of people at a given time mortgage their properties, leave their families to embark on an expedition 3,000 kilometers or more away to a land they've never been to before, know nothing about, right? That they've only heard about in church, as referenced in the Bible, a place like Antioch, right? To take on a seemingly impossible task of winning a war in a land that is filled with millions of Muslims who may or may not want them there.
Right.
And then somehow on that journey, even being, for example, during the Peasants' Crusade, being incredibly poor, figuring out a way to feed yourself when you have no money, figuring out a way to fight when you're not a trained soldier,
right?
Marching into almost certain death with, you know, your shovel, you know, whatever you happen to have with you. And then, having done all that, somehow make it back home to tell the story.
Right.
What compels people to do that? That does not sound very attractive to me. I don't want to do that. So the cynical explanations to say, well, it's money. Okay, yeah, money, sure, right? Does that really explain the people? Are people that profit-driven that they will surrender their entire life, say goodbye to wife and kids and whatnot, you know, and just go off in search of money? Or do you need something deeper?
Right.
And so, it, as you can see, it's complicated.
right. It sends a theme here. So we've covered kind of the center of the concentric circles, the numbered crusades, as you said earlier, the ones to the Levant and then to defend the Levant. What about the other ones? What about, you brought up the Reconquista, what about the Northern Crusades into what are sometimes Christian lands? What about the Albigensian Crusade? What do you make of those? How do you fit them into this picture?
Right. And this is where you start to expand your definitions, right? So if you start to, yet another school of thought, right? You get into what so-called generalists, right? If you start thinking, all right, crusade, it's not so much the crusade. Mm-hmm. It's crusading, right? Crusading is what? Well, it is a campaign, right? A Christian campaign against what? Well, sure, recovering land, right?
Mm-hmm.
Saving holy spaces, fighting for your soul, all these sorts of things. But you could cast it as it's sort of warring against unbelief or against wrong belief. Or against the fallen, right? And so if you think about it in those terms, you can start to employ the device in different ways. So you mentioned the heresy, right? So the Albigensian Crusade, right? 1209 to 1229.
Mm-hmm.
You have a southern France, Languedoc, which is full of heretics, apparently, right? You have these Cathars running all over the place, right? And it's very difficult to know who's a Cathar. You go into a room, you say, I don't know, they're all dressed the same. Who's a Cathar, right? Well, they have this belief that is believed to be heretical. Heretical beliefs, by definition, if you believe in them, are going to doom your soul to hell, right? You're not going to heaven with heretical beliefs. Well, what's the difference in the medieval mind between a heretic in southern France, right? Versus a Jew
mm-hmm.
who doesn't believe in Christ as the Messiah, or versus the Muslim, right, who doesn't believe in Christian notions, right? Well, they're kind of all the same. So you can legitimately fight against any of them, right? Or a pagan up in Lithuania,
right?
They're sort of all the same, right? So the idea is you extend the concept and say, well, maybe if this is the great Christian war against unbelief, against divergent beliefs, as well as possibly reacquisition of land. And we say, well, if southern France is full of heretics, we need to cleanse it of heretics and thereby get the land back, right? If Spain is full of Muslims, we need to cleanse the Muslims down there and get the land back.
And also the Jews, well.
And also the Jews. There. Well, they're there, right? Yeah. Sure. So you can start to kind of play with the meaning of it, right?
Yeah.
So you get these real interesting manifestations where people are inspired to go on campaign. They're inspired to go crusading.
Right.
And I should point out, one of the things the generalists have done a really good job of pointing to is it's not just that you got to get out of the box of just a crusade. If you start looking at architecture, devotional art, sermons, literature, the histories that are being written, right? If you start looking at the culture, crusading permeates the fabric of medieval culture. It's everywhere. You don't have to read a book about a crusade to know that crusading is a thing. It's in the stained glass windows, right? You can see it. The
right.
stories are told. They're sung by, you know, poets are writing about it, right? So you take that idea of crusading and you say, well, there are other places where meritorious works for Christ can be done. And so we will go there and we will do it. And it will be very often directed by Rome. And not directed in like running things, but in the sense of
aimed, maybe
sort of aiming, but also enabling, right? So if you think about like the military religious orders, like the Teutonic Knights, right? Well, they're going to be legitimized, right, by the papacy. This is a legitimate religious holy order you can join. It's going to have an order that you follow. We approve of this, right? The Teutonics are very interested in what's going on in Northeast Europe, and we will sort of sponsor their activities and even suggest to them that you have not only our permission, but our, you know, our prayers,
right,
to go and do this. So you get crusading in places that are not Jerusalem. Right. So Northeast Europe, good example, right? Livonia, Estonia, fighting against the Wends, right? Prussia, Lithuania, places where there are some Christians, but there is paganism, right? And you go and you fight the holy war there. And
yeah.
you say, well, what does that have to do with Jerusalem? Well, at the end of the day, the physical Jerusalem, very little, right? On the other hand, yeah, well, Lithuania, right? And could there be a Jerusalem in the north, right?
Right.
You know, a place in the north. And so, but whatever you're saying is that these are pagans, right, who are preventing Christendom from expanding, or maybe they're even contracting it, right? And so it's a worthwhile pursuit.
Mm-hmm.
So that means later on you want to go against the Ottomans, sure, right? It doesn't even matter where the Ottomans are, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can go fight against them. So the concept develops over time and starts to manifest in all over the places. And then you see, it's just as we're talking about this, how these schools of thought are then going to start to conflict, right?
Right.
If you are a traditionalist and you say a crusade is only a papally sponsored holy war against Jerusalem, well, then the Northeast Northeast Wars can't be crusades.
Right.
Right? You have to reject them.
Nor can the Reconquista.
Yeah, that's not a crusade either.
Right.
Right? Whatever's going on in Sicily, that's not a crusade.
Right. Or Louis' campaigns to Egypt. Okay. They kind of maybe aimed at Jerusalem?
Well, they are. Those ones are interesting. They are aimed, but there's the original ones, it's very easy to say, where are we going? We're going to Jerusalem, right? And you write a song about it, right? Here we go. Well, how do you get to Jerusalem? Do you sail right there in time? And it happens in the 12th century. You can take Jerusalem and you can hold it for a while. But as I said, there's millions of Muslims out there and eventually you might just lose it, right? Instead, the more savvy strategists start saying, you know what? In order to take and actually hold this land and make it meaningful, you have to destroy the centers of Muslim military power, right? And so you get this concept that originates known as the Egyptian strategy, right? it Jerusalem doesn't matter unless you conquer Egypt. Egypt is where the bulk of the soldiers come from, right? So let's go to Egypt first, conquer Egypt. Once you do, you secure the southern flank, and then that enables you to hold Jerusalem. So when Louis goes to Egypt on the Seventh Crusade, he's going to secure the southern flank first, right? And it's probably the appropriate strategy, right? When he goes on the Eighth Crusade, he just starts a little further to the west by going to Tunisia as maybe an easier way to slip into Egypt, right? But yeah, you start to say, well, where are you going? Well, I'm going here. Well, is that a crusade? The Second Crusade has 10,000 sailors that sail to Lisbon in Portugal and capture the city of Lisbon. Is that a crusade? Well, it's being held by a Muslim warlord. Okay, so it's a Muslim-controlled city in a territory that used to be Christian, but they were supposed to go to Jerusalem. Yeah, they just never make it there, right? So, but is what they have done, do we call this an Iberian Crusade? It's sometimes called the Dartmouth Crusade because that's where it begins, the Lisbon Crusade. Or in the medieval terms, just an expeditione. It's a it's not a crusade. It's a campaign, right? So now now it's all squirrely. So one is tempted to step back and say, well, it's all crusading. Well, okay, now you've got another problem.
Right, now you have a meaningless term.
Yeah, it's basically meaningless. So all warfare is crusading? Well, not this kind and not this kind and not this kind. Does it have to be warfare against non-Christians? Well, clearly no, because there are going to be crusades launched against Christians. So it gets very squirrely. I think it's probably fruitless to try to figure out and set it down. And numerous books and articles keep getting written about this stuff. I think the idea is that there is a spirit that somehow awakens in European Christendom, probably beginning. I don't know. Maybe it goes back to Charlemagne.
Charlemagne's the fly in the ointment here, right? Because he was conducting holy wars against the non-Christians of, say, Saxony. Mm. And it looks a whole lot like a crusade.
Yeah, you're going against the Saxons, putting a sword to their throat and forcing them to convert,
burning their sacred trees.
Yeah, So maybe it's this sort of spirit, the idea that I think maybe gets you more back to just the idea of just kind of classical medieval just war concepts, right? Yeah. God wants us to fight. There are some times when God wants us to fight. And for St. Augustine, the idea was you look at the book of Joshua, right? God is telling Joshua to fight. He's actually helping him kill people, right? Yeah. So there are some times when God wants you to fight. And you get this burgeoning idea that God wants us to go out and fight for him in a variety of places in a variety of ways. And somehow that, in time, gets all kind of lumped as crusading,
right?
That said, I think there are definite moments where you look at it and say, sure, they're fighting for God, but I just don't think we can call that a crusade. And it comes back to your definitions. What are you fighting for? Who is leading you on?
One of the really interesting things that I think is maybe worth talking about is the Reconquista leads into Spanish colonialism, also Portuguese colonialism, but the Spanish is larger and in many ways more problematic. The language that the popes use around colonialism, around Spanish colonialism, is the language of holy war. Mm-hmm. They are telling the Spanish, go Christianize these people. And then when the Spanish are just doing land grabs, the popes come in later and say, hey, you have to actually Christianize these people. And once you Christianize them, you got to treat them like Christians. So the language is the same. What do we make of that in this picture of crusading?
Yeah, I mean, there's some people who want to call that crusading. The new edition of a very popular textbook on the Crusades has a Spanish galleon on the front, right? Which kind of is pushing that idea that does this mean that we are, that Christopher Columbus is a crusader? That Francisco Pizarro is a crusader? Hernando Cortez, right? We call him a conquistador, but maybe he's a crusader, right? These people, when they land in the New World, They're calling their settlements Veracruz. They're naming it after the True Cross.
True Cross, yeah. And I would imagine, like you talked about earlier, this kind of eschatological view. When Cortez is marching on what is now Mexico City, and everything seems to be working for him, I mean, that's hard to not see in that same eschatological apocalyptic vein.
Well, especially if you look at the evolving theology around last times things, right? Jesus says to his apostles, go and preach the gospel to all peoples, baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, Holy Spirit, right? What happens when the gospel is finally preached to everyone on earth?
Right.
Is that the time that Jesus returns?
Right.
And so you say, okay, well, we've discovered new lands, and we've brought, now we're bringing the gospel there, and we're preaching. There are prominent voices saying we must do this to bring about the return of Jesus.
Yeah.
And the most just judgment of the world, right? Well, and you discover India, and you end up in Japan, and you end up in these places, and who's going? Well, here come the Jesuit missionaries, right? And you have to push that in. So it's an important question. Is that crusading? Can you take Hernando Cortez and say he is leading a crusade, right? So go to the documents, right? What do we know about the forces impelling him on? What are the things he's saying? Oh, he's fighting for Jesus. Okay, right? Is it a Christian holy war? Maybe you come down and say it is a Christian holy war. Okay, does it match a crusade? And that's at the point where I start to say, you know, I think maybe we're getting, are we getting a little ridiculous?
Well, if everything is a crusade, nothing's a crusade.
Yeah, which then drives you back to your very first question. What is a crusade? Okay, and it makes me want to put parameters on it then and say, okay, so maybe a crusade is limited, taking that notion of lands that were formerly Christian, right?
Which rules out the New World.
Rules out the New World. Maybe we're talking about the parameters of Old Rome.
Yeah.
So if you're in North Africa, if you're in Spain, if you're in the Levant, if you are in Germania up to a certain point.
Right. Not Livonia.
Right. Maybe that's the extent of a crusade. Yeah, but then Hostler, the problem is people were fighting in Britannia before the crusading period against pagan Scots. Britannia was part of Rome. And so instantly my definition is wrong,
right?
It also doesn't account for the Northeastern Crusades, where I don't think you can leave them out because the rhetoric and the things they're saying, they're so clearly tied to crusading ideals, right? And so this is the eternal problem. What is a crusade? What is not a crusade? It's led some people to say, well, maybe you have to come back to that papal backing. But that doesn't help us with the explorers and the conquistadors.
Right, because they had strong papal backing.
Right. Is the Inquisition a part of the crusade? Oh, well, right. Nah, it's not part of it. Okay, but what are you doing, right? You're combating unbelief. And so, so it's, as time goes on, I tend to just, and I know it's totally punting, I tend to just stop worrying about it. You know, is this a crusade? Is this not a crusade? You can have that fight. I tend to more and more with time buy into this kind of generalist notion that crusading as a thing is out there, and it's morphing into the idea that, not unlike things like Manifest Destiny, that there is a future out there for Christians, and that part of it will be gained through Christian warfare.
Mm-hmm.
And whether or not it's an explicit crusade versus a holy war, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is, I think, not as important. But that's just me.
Yeah, that's a good conclusion. And I know one of the things I tell students frequently is we often center ourselves in World War II, which is an easy war. It's got obvious enemies. It's got an obvious strategic level conclusion, the unconditional surrender of the enemies. But in many ways, that's the exception. These things tend to be, as you've said throughout, they tend to be complicated and confused. And at any given time, there are several motives within an individual, much less within a force or a country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
All right, fascinating discussion, Dr. Hostler. Thank you.
Thanks for having me. Enjoyed it.
If you like this episode, please make sure to check out our other podcast, Broad Gauge Gossips, where we talk to members of the Department of Military History faculty so you can get to know them.